call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. I see that we have a quorum present. Members will be going until noon today, and if we are unable to finish the agenda, we'll recess and reconvene at 5 o'clock in room 400 South. And for those of you who are here to testify today, we really appreciate you, but we have 7 bills on our agenda, and so we're going to be moving through them quickly, so please try to keep your testimony as succinct as possible. We need to move the minutes from March 5th, 2020. May I have a motion for that?
So moved.
Chair Considine moves approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2020. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes for March 5th, 2020 are approved. Chair Dean, I believe you have House File 3397. A bill for an act relating to real property, clarifying ownership definitions, and requiring the record owner to be listed as a grantee in tax forfeited land sales. I move that House File 3397 be recommended to be placed on the general register. No.
Madam Chair, I believe we have to make a stop in Texas.
Okay. So I will move that House File 3397 be recommended to be re-referred to the tax committee. All right, go ahead, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is, I know that you've got a lot of bills, so we won't try not to take up too much of your time. This is a bill that actually, excuse me, I actually am doing a lot better, that protects some homeowners from what I would say are being brought into some unscrupulous financial instruments to try to assist them when they find themselves in difficult places. And ultimately what this does is it allows them to actually have some protection through this process. And I don't know the bill as well in detail as my testifier here, Mr. Elwood, does. So I will turn it over to him because I could talk for 20 minutes and not get you the important information.
All right, thank you. Welcome back, Mr. Elwood. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I know you have a lot of bills, so we'll be very quick. This is pretty much of a cleanup bill from, unfortunately, many years ago. It does two things. It addresses, well, first of all, the overriding thing is the it modifies two sections of law, two chapters of law. One is the equity stripping law, the foreclosure rescue scam law, chapter 325N, which was enacted in 2004 to address these unscrupulous equity stripping scams. And then it also amends chapter 282, which governs what the county's procedures are in tax forfeiture. So these equity stripping scams in general are pretty insidious, and basically they're intended by the scammers to take the home and the equity right out from under the homeowner when they're in trouble. And in 2004, this legislature in a strong bipartisan bill passed a very extensive law to address these kinds of scams. It was extremely effective in terms of the mortgages, but it did not address other situations where a person could lose their home, like tax forfeiture. In 2007, the legislature expanded this statute and protections to cover all those other situations, tax forfeiture, if you're being foreclosed on for homeowner association dues, something like that. Unfortunately, as is wont to happen, not all the T's were crossed and not all the I's were dotted. And there are some areas of the 325N where it still only refers to mortgage foreclosure. So the second part of the bill, the second sections of this bill, I think it's 5 to 7, what that part of the bill does is simply make it clear what the legislature said in 2007 it meant, and that these protections and this statute apply across the board in any situation where somebody could lose their home through default or delinquency or something like that. The first part of the bill, sections 1 through 4, have come to us from Hennepin County, and Hennepin County has been working with Legal Aid in working on these kinds of seeing these kinds of scams. And what sections 1 through 4 do, simply codify their practice of when somebody is in a repurchase situation, they want to give the quitclaim deed back to the homeowner, not to the scammer. And that's their practice, and this codifies that. Before I just bring up my colleague from Legal Aid, who can tell you one quick story about how this will actually help people, I want to do a couple of things. I want to thank the Representative Dean for carrying the bill. I'd like to thank co-author Representative Mahler on the bill. I'd like to thank Hennepin County and all the folks with whom we vetted this bill and who have provided some technical help. The Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the Minnesota State Bar Association's Real Property Section, the Minnesota Land Title Association, Minnesota Realtors, the Minnesota Association of Counties, and the Community Association Institute, which are the folks that deal with the condo associations. They've all vetted this bill and are and have no opposition, have helped us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, and thank you for not listing those all as acronyms. We appreciate it. It's a lot. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Hi, my name is Brittany McCormick. I'm a staff attorney in the consumer unit at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. I want to thank Representative Dean for bringing forward House File 3397. This bill will have a direct impact on our clients. Ron mentioned a story. So my supervisor and I had a client come in who was already had been behind on his property taxes for years and was in a repurchase agreement with Hennepin County, and he was falling behind on that too. It's basically a 10-year plan where you pay back your property taxes over time to keep your house. And a scammer had come, that information is public, which is one of the reasons that scammers are attracted to these things. They can just look at the property tax rolls and pick off people who are behind. And a lot of times they're elderly and disabled people that are our clients. And this older gentleman was approached by a scammer, and the scammer said, why don't you just give me title to your house and I'll pay off the county for you. You can stay in the house and you can pay me back over time. It'll work out. You can rent it from me. And this old man who really wanted to just stay in his house said okay and signed the title over to his house. And of course this equity stripper took all the equity in it. It didn't have a mortgage, so there was massive amounts of equity in it. My supervisor and I looked at the statute and realized, well, this statute doesn't really work for us because it was geared mostly towards mortgages, because the mortgage kept popping up throughout different parts of the statute. So this bill would fix that, and it would be unequivocally applied to situations like this gentleman where he was approached by someone who was taking advantage of the fact that he wasn't behind on his mortgage, he was behind on his property taxes.
Great. Thank you so much. Are there any other testifiers? Anyone from the public? All right. I don't see any, so member questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick procedural question. You had said that this should go to taxes. I believe you meant property taxes. Is that correct?
Okay. That's correct. And we'll, who do you want to take your?
You'll amend the.
You can take it now. Yeah, let's do questions and then we'll fix the motion. Thank you. Are there questions for members? Maybe we should just do it now then. Okay. Seeing none, Representative Carlson, do you have a motion?
I do. So with regards to the next location for this bill, I'd like to recommend that we re-refer House File 3396 to the property, I'm sorry, 3697. Thank you.
Nope.
What did I say?
It's going to be a long day.
3397.
Help him out there, Mom.
Too many bills today. Okay, I'm going to say this all over again. House File 3397 to the Property and Local Tax Division.
Okay, any discussion on that? Are we? Okay, all right. Okay, any more discussion on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And House
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good luck with your next six bill.
Thank you. House File 3397 is recommended to be re-referred to the Property Tax Division. All right, next is House File 3627, Representative Katiza Watoon. And come on up and tell us about your bill. Well, before you do that, I'll move that House File 3627 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And I do notice that you have an amendment, Representative, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Katiza Watoon has an author's amendment labeled A1. And may I have, I'll move that the bill be put in the form the author wants. You have an A2?
A2. This is technically the A2 amendment.
It's the A2 amendment. Okay, I'll move that. The A2 amendment be adopted.
Yeah.
Sorry. All right. I'll move that the A2 amendment be adopted to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Do we have any discussion on the A2 amendment? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. And then go ahead, Representative, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3627 is a reverse mortgage senior homeowner protection bill. It is intended to protect seniors who wish to age gracefully and age in place by remaining in their homes. We want to prevent unnecessary foreclosures of reverse mortgages. A reverse mortgage is like a loan, is a loan like a traditional mortgage that is secured by the home and its value. But rather than the homeowner making monthly payments to the lender gives an upfront or monthly payment to the homeowner. It is a tool to help seniors remain in their homes. The homeowner is still responsible for paying property taxes and homeowner's insurance, and the loan comes due when the home is no longer the primary residence of the owner. Here in Minnesota and across the country, we've seen an upsurge in these types of loans. And in a 2019 report, the General Accounting Office indicates that defaults on reverse mortgages have actually risen almost tenfold, from 2% in 2014 to 18% in 2018. This dramatic increase in reverse mortgage foreclosures is due to the failure of more and more senior homeowners to pay their property taxes or insurance, or to certify annually, as typically is required, that the home is still their primary place of residence. So this bill hopes to prevent these types of foreclosures by doing three things. We provide the opportunity to designate a third party to receive notices of defaults or delinquencies that could lead to foreclosure. Require the servicer to send those notices to the third party, and then we also give the borrower an opportunity to stop the foreclosure if those notices have not been sent.
Thank you, Representative, and I see you have a testifier, so welcome back, and if you can introduce yourself again, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Representative Katiza Watoon for bringing this bill. I also want to point out there should be a couple of letters in your packet from Lutheran Social Service and also from the Homeownership Center and Habitat for Humanity in support of this bill. And again, I just want to point out that we have vetted this bill with a number of stakeholders who have provided substantial and very helpful technical suggestions, which are incorporated. Some were incorporated in Commerce, and the amendment that you have before you today incorporates a couple more. And so, again, I'd like to thank the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the Minnesota State Bar Association's Real Property Section, the Minnesota Land Title Association, Minnesota Realtors, the Minnesota Association of Counties, the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, the Municipal Legislative Commission, and the Homeownership Center. We do have, if you believe it's necessary, I know you have a long agenda, we have Ms. McCormick again can tell you a story of exactly how this bill would help clients, but I guess given your agenda.
Well, Mr. Elwood, I find those stories to be helpful, and since she's here, if you could come forward and just briefly explain, that would be fantastic. And please introduce yourself again for the committee.
Sure. Again, it's Brittany McCormick, a staff attorney in the Consumer Unit at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. So we have a lot of homeowners, older homeowners in reverse mortgage situations, and when they enter the reverse mortgage, they may have had their full faculties, but this is like 5 or 10 years down the road. Maybe a spouse has passed away who took care of the finances, or maybe they have diminished mental capacity due to dementia or other mental health issues. So they often, bottom line, they forget to pay their property taxes, or they don't realize that they have to keep having homeowners insurance on their home. They went their whole lives with a forward mortgage and that those things were taken care of by the escrow account. Now that there's a reverse mortgage, it's often one thing that gets missed, and that is a cause for a servicer to foreclose on the house and take the house before the homeowner dies, which is the deal that they thought they made when they signed up for the mortgage. So I had a couple where the man, the husband was, you know, did the finances their whole life and then got dementia. And one of the outcomes of that was that he didn't tell his wife where he was putting notices or bills. He didn't tell her that he hadn't been paying his property their property taxes. So she came to us when they were $14,000 behind to Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo had been paying these property taxes the whole time. And they said, if you don't pay us in 30 days, you know, you're going to have to lose your house. So we could walk that back and you can come to repayment plans with banks like Wells Fargo and other servicers. But it's really difficult. And if a third party, if a son or daughter in a different state or wherever they live could get involved just a little bit sooner before these become crisis situations, it's not really legal work that they need. They need a very, they need a person who can come in, open mail, talk to a servicer, and this bill would do just that.
Great, thank you. Do we have anybody else from the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, I don't see any questions from members. All right, seeing none, I move that House File 3627, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 3627, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Next up, we have House File 3228 with Representative Morrison. And it's my understanding that we are going to be focusing on some very specific data provisions in this bill. I will move that House File 3228 be recommended to be re-referred to the HHS Policy Committee. Welcome, Representative Morrison, and go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3228 would establish a prescription drug affordability commission to give the state the ability to limit how much Minnesotans pay for certain high-cost drugs. I'd like to give a brief overview of what the prescription affordability commission does and the need for the commission, and then I'll focus my comments on the provisions that this committee has jurisdiction over. And the Office of the Attorney General should be here also to answer questions about those provisions. The cost of prescription drugs continue to skyrocket in the United States, making it difficult for Minnesotans to afford their prescriptions. Unless we do more to keep costs down, more people will not be able to afford their drugs, leading to poor health outcomes and higher health care costs. This legislation is based on a National Academy of State policy model. Most recently, both Maryland and Maine have passed into law and established prescription drug affordability boards. You're all familiar with all of the examples of the high cost of drug prices, but just to remind you of a few egregious ones, the cost of Bavencio, a new cancer drug approved several years ago, is about $156,000 a year per patient. There's a new muscular dystrophy drug that came on the market for a price of $300,000 annually. In 2016, the FDA approved a new bladder cancer treatment that costs $12,500 a month or $150,000 a year. Even older drugs that have been on the market are not immune. The cost of insulin has tripled between 2002 and 2013, despite no notable changes in the formulation. And the four-decade-old EpiPen, a life-saving allergy medication, has seen a price hike of 500% since 2007. Clearly, more must be done to rein in the cost, the high cost of medications. The Prescription Drug Affordability Commission is an independent body that evaluates drug prices and sets a maximum reimbursement level, also known as an upper payment limit, if a drug's price is excessive and prevents an affordability challenge for the state's health system or patients. The payment limit applies throughout the state healthcare system to protect consumers, state and local governments, healthcare companies, providers, pharmacies, and other stakeholders. Drug companies will have the opportunity to report to the board and explain their prices. The bill establishes a commission whose members have relevant experience and are without conflicts of interest and are appointed by the governor and the House and Senate. The bill also establishes an 11-member advisory council to provide advice to the commission and is made up of stakeholders, including drug manufacturers, employers, health plan companies, providers, researchers, advocates, and state government. Not all drugs will be reviewed by the Affordability Commission. A drug manufacturer must notify the commission if it increases a drug's price above thresholds set in law for brand name, generic, biosimilar, and biologic drugs. As stated in Section 6 and 7 of the bill, the information submitted to the Commission related to drug cost review shall be available to the public, with the exception of information that is likely to compromise the financial or competitive position of the drug manufacturer or information that would qualify as a trade secret. Section 8 allows for the Office of the Attorney General to enforce and pursue remedies if it finds that an entity was non-compliant with the Commission reimbursement requirements. In addition, there is an appeals process established in law so that any person affected by the decision of the Commission may request an appeal within 30 days of the decision. And finally, Section 11 establishes the severability clause. So with that, I have, I believe, two testifiers, if that is
okay with you, Madam Chair. If you want to come up, and I'll just point out to the members, too, that we are limiting the scope of the discussion to data in this bill. That's Section 3, Subdivision 7. Section 7, Subdivision 4, and then an appeals provision in Section 8, Subdivisions 2 and 4. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Phillips. I'm the state director with AARP Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Morrison for bringing this bill forward. I'm here on behalf of 650,000 members of AARP here in our state. And we very much appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3228, which establishes the Prescription Drug Affordability Commission to ensure that drug prices are reasonable, justified, and support improved consumer access and affordability. AARP members, just like everybody else, struggle every day to afford needed and life-saving medications. We know high drug costs hurt everyone, not only those who rely on prescription drugs for their health and chronic conditions, but all of us who are paying higher premiums, higher out-of-pocket costs for health insurance, as well as all of us as taxpayers who fund public programs. Americans have continued to see their drug prices skyrocket, and as AARP research shows, nothing stops drug companies from changing the highest price the market will bear, and the result has been and continues to be prices that make little sense but lots of profit. Under this bill, the Prescription Drug Affordability Commission would give Minnesota the ability to limit how much residents and state-regulated entities pay for certain high-cost drugs that present affordability challenges to the state, healthcare system, or to patients. And importantly, the bill grants the Attorney General the authority to pursue remedies against drug manufacturers who are in non-compliance with the levels set by the Commission and if there's evidence of intentional profiteering. Bills such as this one and others introduced this session stop prescription drug price gouging and can save us all money, patients, taxpayers, and our healthcare system. But more importantly, they can help us ensure that all Minnesotans have access to the drugs that they need to get and stay healthy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Anybody from the audience who wishes to testify? Come on forward, please. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chairman and the committee. My name is Travis Paulson and I'm a resident of Eveleth, Minnesota. I dedicate my time to advocating. I run an organization called Northern Minnesota Advocacy Group. We teach patients how to fight against high prescription drugs, and we organize regular caravans to Canada and put our patients in touch with their legislators. So I do this all in the name of getting affordable medication, and that's what brings me here today. So I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Business Management and Business Administration, and I went on to enjoy a pretty fulfilling career in investigative finance. I had a pretty good life and owned my own home. I traveled frequently. And if you fast forward to 2011, I was forced to move back to my childhood home because I could barely afford the medication that was keeping me alive. You see, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 14 years old. I was fortunate enough at the time that my mother could afford my insulin growing up. But by the time I was 25 years old, the insulin prices were rising substantially and I was beginning to get worried. By the time I was 30 and under a new insurance plan, I had a rude awakening. The deductible was $7,500 a year, and my insulin cost $300 a vial. So for me, that was roughly $1,500 a month out of pocket. So the financial toll was overwhelming. And by the time the financial crisis of 2007 hit, I had pretty much lost everything, including my home. The dollar store became my grocery store, and powdered soup packets and break rooms had become my breakfast and lunch. I traveled around the country working odd jobs during the crisis, just living paycheck to paycheck just so I could afford the insulin I needed to stay alive. Now, my health is what ultimately paid the price during this. I was rationing insulin with the hopes that it would last longer, and eventually I would always run out. So there were several times that I was forced to go without my insulin completely, and often I could barely scrape together enough to get a Walmart bottle of insulin, which is a 30-year-old poor quality that required me to inject every 3 to 4 hours, 24 hours a day and night. So I've learned since then that I'm very lucky. I could have easily died and didn't know it. Unfortunately, years of rationing insulin has caused long-term complications that wouldn't have had to occur if I had access to affordable insulin. Now, my situation's not unique. I've found that countless life-sustaining medications are priced out of reach for the middle class and working class. I see people struggle under the high cost of prescription drugs all across the state of Minnesota, and we're more or less medical refugees, and our government has no problem with that fact. So we can't allow pharma to keep getting away with the price gouging on drugs that's pricing people out of life-sustaining medications. So I strongly urge everyone in this room to support HF 3228. This bill helps patients to access their medication that they need to survive and just to afford them a quality of life that everybody should deserve.
Thank you so much, Mr. Paulson, and thank you for traveling down here today, sharing your story with us and the work you do to help others. We appreciate it. Is there any other testimony from the audience? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question would go to Representative Morrison. I'm looking through the list of folks that will be comprising this council. And could you point to me the person that's the expert on determining what is and is not proprietary information?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. That is not explicitly laid out in the bill, but there are it's established in law and in the bill elsewhere that proprietary information is not to be disclosed publicly.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So which one of these members or members of how you have it laid out in your bill on page 4, which one of these members do you think is most qualified to determine what is proprietary and what's not proprietary?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, again, I repeat, it's laid out in the bill. I guess I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Yeah, go ahead, Chair.
Thank you. Could you point out to me where in the bill it's laid out? I mean, who is, yeah, go ahead.
Give me one sec.
Chair Scott, are you looking at section 4, the bill, just for clarification here?
I'm looking at, yes, Madam Chair, I'm looking at page 4, section 4, and wondering which of the members on that council would be an expert in determining what is proprietary and what is not proprietary information.
Okay, thank you, Chair Scott.
Well, the individuals who are coming to testify.
Yeah. Maybe does council have some insight into that? Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe that the section that gives the authority to determine proprietary information is actually in Section 7, Subdivision 4. That's the public data proprietary information piece. It references any submission made to the commission that's related to a drug cost review shall be made available to the public. And then paragraph B says that the commission shall establish the standards for information to be considered proprietary. The commission is the commission, I believe, that's established in Section 3 of the bill, which begins page 2, line 25. And that's the commission that consists of the five members that are generally appointed by the governor and members of the legislature. There is some direction in paragraph B saying that all those members must have some knowledge and demonstrate expertise in healthcare, economics, and finance. And it says a member must not be an employee of, a board member of, or a consultant to a manufacturer or trade association for manufacturers. Don't believe there's any specific language there related to identifying proprietary information. One final addition in that subdivision 4 I referenced, there is opportunity for public comment related to determining what would be proprietary information. That language is on page 9 at lines 23 and 24.
Chair Scott.
Thank you for that, Madam Chair and staff. It still doesn't outline that there's still no one on the commission or on the council that has any expertise in determining what's proprietary and what's not. In my opinion, you'd almost need some sort of a lawyer that practices in this realm in order to determine that. I mean, for something like this, when you have companies that, and whether it's this issue or any other, when you have companies that invest millions and millions of dollars in research for their product, and then the determination for whether or not it's proprietary is going to be made by people that have zero knowledge of that process. I think this is troublesome. So, I have concerns about this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you for your comments, Representative Scott. I do want to point out that the advisory council includes, as council mentioned, members with expertise in healthcare economics. So I do think that your concern is addressed in the bill, but I appreciate your comment.
Any other questions from members? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill came before Commerce, and I'm trying to determine if you've made any changes since Commerce. I know you've first engrossment now. I'm looking specifically at page 10, subdivision 4, which talks about appeals. And if you could just go through just the appeal process. And here's a specific question. You said a person affected. Can you explain who you mean by person affected? Who is that? Someone that had to pay high drug cost, or I'm trying to understand this, because last time we talked about this bill when I was in Commerce, you talked about, you know, this commission would decide if something was too high, and then they'd have to kind of go back and forth with pharma, but you have no staff other than one executive director, but you don't have lawyers, you don't have accountants, you don't have anybody to actually delve into the pharma's explanation of the cost. So you're talking about multi-billion dollar companies with nobody on the state side to actually look deep into what they're doing. So I'm confused in this line 10.24, whose person, who is that that is affected? And then the last time the bill was before committee I was on, the appeal process was appeal to the same body that had made the decision, which is a little interesting. So like here, right? So if you're in district court and you don't like the decision, you appeal to the appeals court. So I see you've, I'm not sure if you've added line 10.27 or not, but can you just go through that? And is that as substantially different than when you were in Commerce? And just how does that section work? Because I'm really confused as to what this is actually trying to accomplish.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. There was a lot in that. And I appreciated your comments in the previous committee as well. And we did do some looking into some of your concerns. This will be under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Health. I think that was one of your questions. And in terms of the appeals process, I would defer to the Attorney General's office to answer that question specifically. But as you say, in line 10.27, they're subject to judicial review.
There is pay accounted for to, there's the opportunity to hire an executive director and to staff up the commission. Some of this is an unknown because we won't know how many drugs will trigger the thresholds. So there will need to be some kind of a review in terms of how the commission is funded and how much money it will need to run, I think, after a year. I hope that addresses some of your questions.
Right, thank you. And actually, can we have council just explain what that reference is to Chapter 14 for us? That would be great. Okay, go ahead, Ms. Mullins.
Chair and members, the Chapter 14 is the standard administrative review process that allows you to take an administrative decision to court. So that's what that chapter does.
Okay, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the author, is that something that you've added then? Is 10.27 something that you've added since Commerce?
Representative Morrison.
I just don't recall it being there before.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, no.
Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So who is the person that is affected by the decision? Because is that the person that triggers the concern that the drug is too high? I'm just not understanding how does this process start from the inception so I understand what the appeal is for.
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, persons would be individuals and healthcare entities, as laid out earlier in the bill.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just not quite understanding because it maybe you could start it. Where does this process start? So does a citizen say, hey, I'm paying too much for my drug, and they send it to the commission? Is that how it starts, or how does this whole process start? Because maybe that's who this person affected by the decision. In other words, the person doesn't like their new price on the drug. I'm not quite sure what this language
There are,
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, there are thresholds for wholesale acquisition costs that are triggers for drugs to be evaluated.
Yep. Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then if there's automatic triggers, then I don't understand the language here, like which person would be eligible to bring an appeal. That's what doesn't make sense to me. So if there's an automatic trigger to say, okay, we're going to start this process, then do you have a complainant? Do you have a citizen? I mean, who is this person affected by the decision that will have the, who has the authority, who has the right to actually do the appeal? That's the question, because the language isn't clear here.
And Representative Morrison, I think, is there someone from the Attorney General's office, perhaps, that could help with some of this?
Madam Chair, there is someone from the Attorney General's office who is supposed to be here, who hopefully has arrived.
All right. Come on forward.
There she is.
Thanks. Please introduce yourself, and if you can shed some light on Representative O'Neill's questions, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Carly Moline with the Attorney General's Office. First, my apologies, as I did just walk in, so I unfortunately missed most of the discussion here. So if you could repeat some of your questions, I can do my best to try to answer them.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. And welcome back.
Thank you.
It's always good to see a former member. So I'm on page 10 specifically, if you have the bill in front of you. It's always nice to see the language. And my question specifically is the section about appeals on subdivision 4 and it's lines 10.24 through 10.27. I'm just confused because in our conversation, it sounds like there is a trigger and not a specific complaint by a citizen, and yet the language says a person affected by the decision of the commission may request an appeal of the commission's decision. And I'm trying to understand who is the person that, who is the individual that refers to, since it's an automatic trigger of a drug price that's too high. So who, person means an individual is affected by a decision. So who is the person that's eligible to trigger an appeal?
Ms. Helene, if you know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Neill, I don't know if I'm positioned to answer that question right now. I can try to get back to you with an answer. I mean, in looking at the language, to me that would be a person who is a user of the pharmaceutical, perhaps, you know, whether or not they would have standing, I'm not sure. But I can't answer that question right now.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's kind of problematic because that's what we do here is understand who has the legal authority to bring forward an appeal. And I understand now that, you know, it's a judicial review. I get that. But it would be good to know who are we talking about. Like, if there's an automatic trigger to the drug price, then there's not a complaint by a citizen to say, hey, this drug's too high because it's automatic. So then who actually has the authority to appeal? I think it's important to get that on the record of who has standing.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is to the bill author. Going back, and I was listening to the conversation that and the points that Representative Scott brought up. As I read the bill, I see the advisory council, and then I see the commission. So there's two bodies that are formed here, and I'm understanding the relationship between the two bodies is that the advisory council will provide information to the commission, and specifically it says to provide advice to the commission on drug cost issues and to represent stakeholder views. So that's the purpose of the advisory council. And I, as I heard the bill author's answer as to who is going to determine information that is proprietary and not proprietary, the bill author pointed to the advisory council. But as I read the description of the advisory council, I find the answer from the bill author to be lacking in terms of determining that. So then I look at the commission, and I see the members of the commission are from the governor, the Senate, majority, Senate minority, House majority, and House minority. So a bunch of politicians. So the question I would have, again, to the bill author, because I didn't find the answer to be sufficient, specifically it says in line 9.17, the information made available to the commission will be public with the exception of information deemed by the commission to be proprietary. So again, how is it going to be determined? What's the test if information is proprietary or not?
Representative Moeller, or Representative Morrison.
Chairman,
don't know how often that happens.
Moeller of the KMO caucus. Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, the pharmaceutical industry is represented in the advisory council, and presumably they would be fairly tuned into protecting what they deem to be proprietary information, and they'll be advising the commission.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, so the advisory council advises the commission, and what if the commission doesn't heed the advice of the advisory council on information that the stakeholders have communicated to the advisory council that's proprietary?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, the point of, at some point, decisions have to be made, and so the commission will gather the best available information from their experts on the council to make the determination.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then, to the bill author, what is the recourse if the commission deems information, intellectual property, is not proprietary and therefore is made public? What is the recourse from the industry to hold the commission accountable?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, there is an appeals process.
Is there a follow-up question?
I do. I thought I didn't realize the answer was that was the complete answer. Can you confirm for me that the industry then would have standing on this particular issue to appeal to the commission on proprietary, on what's deemed proprietary and not? And can you point out for me the language in the bill?
Yep. Chair Lesh.
I want to point out that, Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, standing is a legal term of art. It's a constitutional question of standing. And so anyone with a sufficient connection to the matter in question has standing, and that's a legal determination. I don't think it necessarily would need to be spelled out in the bill itself, but maybe I'm misunderstanding what your question is.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then to clarify my question to the bill author, could you point out to me where the language is that if the industry disagrees about what is deemed proprietary and not, where that appeal process is on this particular issue? Because I understand there's an appeal process, but I'm not persuaded that the appeal process is related to the issue I'm addressing.
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, under Subdivision 4, there is a, prior to the commission establishing the standards, there's, the public will be provided notice and there is a comment period to submit comments. And I want to remind you as well that this is not for all drug medications. These are for the egregious outliers that create an affordability challenge for people.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am familiar and I did see the language where there is a comment period provided for the industry when the commission is creating this process. But what I'm seeking is where in the bill the language you cited regarding the appeals process, because a comment period is not an appeals process. Because the industry can give comments in a comment period, and then the commission can establish a process that the industry disagrees with, and then the commission can make proprietary information public that the industry deems as harmful. What is the recourse to the industry in these decisions that are made by this government body of politicians in order to protect their proprietary information when there's a disagreement?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, that there is always recourse in the courts. Part of the reason this bill is coming forward is because the pharmaceutical industry has not been very helpful in making drugs affordable at this point, and we've kind of reached a crisis point.
Just to offer some help, I mean, a laundry list of recourse, a writ of mandamus forcing a public official to perform their duty as prescribed under law, a preliminary injunction, a temporary restraining order in a civil litigation context. I mean, there's a laundry list of probably, I mean, half dozen different measures that the industry could take, and I guarantee you they would take under the guise of trade secret or proprietary information or something along those lines. That would be my best guess. I'm sure there's some other people in this room that are smarter than me that could say that, but that was just initial thoughts.
Well, and Chair Lesh, to piggyback on that, this calls to mind some of the case law surrounding the breathalyzer tests, and that's exactly when that information was being requested, the source code information for the intoxilizers. The industry then, I believe, filed writs and tried to prevent that information from coming forward. So we have seen that in other areas as well. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just final comment. I'm still not satisfied with the answers I was just given, and I am very concerned with this commission that's made up of 7 appointed political sphere types that are going to be controlling prices of the private sector. So we have a government body made up of politicians that's going to set prices. We don't call that a republic or a free market. We call that communism. This is a bad bill.
Representative Morrison, too, just for clarity, you did have a stop in government operations already. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
You can take that.
Okay. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morrison, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I did, and maybe you can answer this question for me, because I'm not seeing this as a body made up of politicians. I'm seeing that it's those politicians that appoint somebody who has knowledge and demonstrated expertise in healthcare, economics, and finance. So this body is not made up of, I'm not appointing myself, or the speaker's not appointing herself. She's appointing somebody who has this expertise. Is that correct?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, that is correct.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morrison. I just wanted to make a comment really quick that I haven't been in the legislature very long, but I've been here long enough to hear when someone doesn't like a bill and they say, you should be more prescriptive, and then when people like bills and they say, it shouldn't be so prescriptive. We should let it have more leeway. And I trust that companies who have billions of dollars know the law and have lawyers on staff that if they know something is proprietary, that they know how to fight that within the system. I don't think they need us to protect them in this law. I appreciate the fact that what you're trying to do with this bill is providing enough prescription as to exactly how some things need to be laid out, but giving enough leeway that an entity is actually going to be created who would create the processes. We as legislators do not actually know how to run the details of within an organization, and that knowing that it is those within those organizations that will have those expertise. So when an executive director is hired, when staff is hired, they will be the ones to know specifically what are the processes and procedures and exactly then how those things play out and put those things, make those things public, because they are a public entity. So I appreciate the fact that you actually laid out a lot of things in very specific terms, but you give enough leeway for those who have expertise or who will be doing the work will be the ones to create those processes and procedures. Again, I just want to reiterate that companies who are making billions of dollars in revenues don't need us to protect them. They know the law. They know how to navigate that. And I just want to share really quick that I had been taking a medication since I was 16. I take a drug called lisinopril. That drug, my copay was $10 a month for 20 years. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, that drug company decided that my copay was going to become $100, and I take this monthly. And so I think that it's really important that even though I'm educated and I've been managing my health for a long time, I had no idea that there were processes that I could participate in, that there are ways that I could actually protect myself and those others using that drug. And thankfully, other people much smarter than myself actually did whatever they did, and within a year, that drug price went back down to like a copay of $10 a month. And so I really appreciate the fact that we're looking at ways to protect people who don't even know they need the protection and have no cultural and social capital to actually protect themselves. And the fact that our job is as legislators to create those frameworks so that that can happen versus us saying, I need to provide every single detail of every process, because that's not our job to do that as well. So thank you so much for bringing this bill forward.
Let's see, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, I want to draw your attention to first page 5, where you lay out the conflicts of interest section. And in the page or line 5.11, it says, has the potential to bias or have the appearance of biasing a person's decision in matters related to the commission or comma, the advisory council. So my first question is, who determines what a potential or the appearance of bias, who would determine that?
And before you answer that, Representative Morrison, I'll just note to Representative Albright, you weren't here when we started, and we are limiting the scope for this committee to those related to data and appeals, and we are making, I'll let her answer the question, but it is going to HHS policy next, so I don't want to go down a long line of questions that aren't related to the specific provisions for this committee. Go ahead, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. The governor appoints the advisory council. Was that your question?
No. Madam Chair, the point, and you articulated it well, my question goes to the point of, this is a public forum. It must follow open meeting law as well as for data protection. And so in the context of determination of whether or not there is an appearance or a potential for bias, that probably has to be archived and recorded in terms of whether that be a financial disclosure statement or some type of public declaration. I'm wondering what happens with that data. If it is public data, it would have a very chilling effect on who would be willing to serve on either of these, particularly the commission, because they would have to disclose financial statements and or holdings pursuant to their availability to the commission. And I'm just wondering how you counter that with an opportunity to participate if indeed you have to basically articulate your whole financial holding statement.
Representative Morrison, do you happen to know the answer to that, or Ms. Moline? I'd just interject into, I don't see that a person's entire holdings have to be. Is there a particular line, Representative Albright, that you can direct us to?
Madam Chair, if you look at lines 5.16 through 5.20, it talks about the financial benefit of any amount deriving from the result or findings of decision. Financial benefit includes honoraria, fees, stock, value of a member or immediate family's member's stock holdings. That's pretty clear to me that if you have a financial investment in the biopharma sector or the medical community or with regard to your mutual fund holdings, with regard to your affiliation with a family that might have holdings, I mean, the extent to which you are requesting holdings and or financial investments for people that might want to participate in this, I think it is very, very broad. And in addition to that, who is going to protect that public data from becoming misused or misappropriated to other agencies or for purposes of leverage against those members? So I see that section alone, and I have a couple other questions, very problematic in terms of protecting the individual's rights to privacy with regard to how they participate on a public commission.
So, Representative Albright, I don't see that still that information has to actually be disclosed and would be public data, and maybe council could shed some light on that for us, please.
Madam Chair, I'll just interject. How will then you determine whether or not there's an appearance or the potential for a bias if you do not discern the holdings of a particular individual?
Well, again, I'm not, Representative Albright, I'm not seeing that they have to actually disclose that, and I would seek some advice from council here as to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright and members, the section that you're referring to, Section 5, Conflicts of Interest, discusses the bias language you mentioned. If you look at Subdivision 2, Paragraph C, it does say that any conflict of interest must be disclosed in advance of the first meeting after the conflict is identified, or within 5 days after the conflict is identified, whichever is earlier. The section is otherwise silent on any other time that a conflict would need to be disclosed.
And Council, that means they disclose the conflict, but does that mean that they have to disclose all of the information with that?
Madam Chair, the bill is silent on that specific information. It simply says the conflict of interest must be disclosed. It doesn't specify whether all the details must be revealed or not.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, this bill is silent on too many objective points, and I'll retain the right to discuss this at a later date.
Okay. Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually going to go back to Representative O'Neill's question. So I don't know if you want to take.
Let's go ahead and do that, please.
Madam Chair and members and Representative O'Neill, on to the point of who persons is in the appeals. As I previously stated, I believe persons is anyone with standing, and I confirmed with our, and I apologize, I'm not the subject matter expert on this bill, and our Assistant Attorney General, who is, wasn't able to be here, but he interpreted that as anyone who has standing in the commission's decision, which would be individuals, manufacturers, wholesale providers, et cetera, would be the who a person would be.
Yep. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand then, even though it says the word person, it can also refer to pharma, the entity of a business within pharma. That's encompassing?
Ms. Moline.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just note, too, under Citizens United, we've got a pretty broad interpret, not to open a whole new can of worms. I just did, but definition of persons is fairly broad. Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this bill.
we at the legislature have a job to do, and our job includes protecting the public. And when folks come to us and tell us that they can afford prescription drugs, drugs that are keeping them alive, then it's our job to do something about it. And that's why I appreciate you bringing this bill. We have heard too many stories of people who are rationing their insulin, people who have lost loved ones because they couldn't afford the drug that was keeping them alive. That is an alarming stories that we keep hearing about people telling us that I lost a loved one, I can't afford my prescription. About one third of my district is senior citizens, and door knocking in my district, I have heard multiple stories of people telling me that they can't afford. These are individuals who are on Social Security and on a limited income. They can't afford the prescriptions that they're on, and they are not on one prescription, they're on multiple prescriptions. And when you have a doctor that comes to us and tells us, we're doing something wrong here, we have to be able to do something about the rising cost of drugs, then we have to be able to do something about that. Thank you.
Right. I don't see any question, any further. Oh, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Just one quick question for the bill author. Representative Morrison, and I just want to make sure I understand this, because conflict of interest in stating those things in the process is not new to this particular commission. People do that in all industry. We do that in the state legislature. We have to fill something out about our conflicts of interest at the beginning of when we're elected, and we only do it at the beginning. We don't have to do it when a new issue comes up. I guess I'm just wondering, because many people in many industries have to do this, is this something brand new, and is this something that hasn't been done before, and why there might be concerns over this, or is this language that is similar to other industries when they have to provide conflicts of interest and how they have to provide that information?
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think you kind of answered your own question, and that a lot of times we ask of or even require people to state any conflicts of interest they might have, so that the public especially has faith that there's a impartial or unbiased commission put together in order to make these decisions, or even if they do have conflicts, that the public is at least aware of what those may be.
We really need to get to close here. Representative Lucero, very quickly, please.
Thank you, and I'm just following up with what Representative Herr just cited. So she's using as an example us as members of the legislature, the statement of economic interest that we have to disclose every year, which then becomes public of all of our sources of income. So, Madam Chair and Representative Herr, you're using as an example the very thing which Representative Albright has a concern with,
that
economic interests and the sources of income is public. I think you're answering Representative Albright's concern definitively that people, in order to disclose their conflicts of interest, the determiners of that are those that are receiving the information. And in our case, because the information becomes public, the public then determines our conflict of interest. In order for somebody to deem a potential candidate for the commission to have a conflict of interest, the information has to be disclosed. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bad bill.
Okay. We've got some more comments and questions. We need to get this to close, and this is going to go to HHS policy.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair.
Very
really quick.
Representative.
I remember filling out the form, and you don't give your dollar amounts. You give where it is that you're invested in, and that information is the bare minimum. And that if that's good enough for us, that should be good enough for an industry that is making billions of dollars off of people. And so if we're in charge with people's lives and we should be disclosing that, so should the individuals who then are making decisions that will impact people enormously.
Madam Chair, we're not in charge of people's lives.
Okay.
You're out of order.
Okay. Okay, we're gonna move this bill on now. Any final words, Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for considering the bill. Thank you for your incisive questions, and I urge support, and thank you for considering it.
Okay, it looks like we have one more question. I'm not sure who it's from here.
Me, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
Okay. All right, a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. I move that House File 3228 be recommended to be re-referred to the HHS Policy Committee.
Chair Mueller.
Yes.
Chair Lesch.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan.
Yes.
Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling. Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Knorr.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
With a vote of 10 yeses and 7 noes, the motion prevails. House File 3228 is recommended to be re-referred to the HHS Policy Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Edelson, come on down. And as she's coming down, I just wanted to comment on, didn't Representative Mueller do a good job chairing the committee? I thought so, too. And, you know, insofar as, you know, referring to a testifier as herself, I can just tell you as chair, there's a lot of stuff going on up here in this space. Okay, a lot. And it's difficult to juggle, and you did outstanding. Well done. With that, we're going to House File 3780, Bill for an Act Relating to Human Services, Modifying...
Oh, Chair, do you think we could do House File 3887 first?
Why not? Okay. We're going to do House File 3887 next. So this is Human Services, Treatment Modifying Provisions Regarding Releasing Records of Civilly Committed Individuals. I move that House File 3887 be recommended be re-referred to HHS policy. Representative Edelson, I don't see any amendments, so go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. We heard House File 2898, which was the larger civil commitment bill. In the process of that bill, we learned through DHS that there was a delay in getting patients the services they need. And so I'm going to let Dr. Stevens tell you a little bit more about how that works, and this bill fixes that. It needed to be vetted here. The goal is to have this added as an amendment tomorrow in HHS Finance.
Go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Edelson and Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Kylie Ann Stevens. I am a physician and psychiatrist by training, and I'm the executive medical director for Direct Care and Treatment, which is the treatment arm of the Department of Human Services. Thank you for your time today to consider changes to the civil commitment statute, which we believe will enhance safety for patients and staff alike. I am the commissioner's designee for decisions regarding admissions across all DCT programs, and I'm also ultimately responsible for the care and treatment our patients receive. As it stands now, when an individual is subject to the priority admission statute, which is commonly referred to as the 48-hour rule, when patients are admitted referred to DCT for admission, in some jurisdictions they must sign a release of information for their medical and behavioral records to be released to us. If they don't sign that release, we're not able to receive the records. We're required to place those patients within 48 hours, but often do not have the information we need to do that safely. Most admissions go to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, or known as AMRTC, which is the largest state-operated psychiatric hospital in the state of Minnesota, located in Anoka, or the Forensic Mental Health Program, commonly referred to as Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. In 2019, AMRTC admitted 333 patients. Of those, 125 were under the priority admission statute, so roughly 38% of patients admitted to AMRTC would be impacted by this change. Upon receiving a commitment order, we commonly receive only a few pages of information from the referring jail, but very little information about medical or psychiatric needs. For example, a patient may have a history of suicide attempts, which we would have no way of knowing about without access to those medical records. This is not an infrequent occurrence. In some cases, individuals have a history of violence toward staff or peers, and without accessing their medical record, we may inadvertently place them with more vulnerable individuals, which obviously creates a safety risk, not only for patients, but for staff as well. Having access to patient records is the standard of care for healthcare settings. Imagine if you were to go to a surgeon for a procedure and refuse to provide her with your medical record. I can pretty much guarantee that the surgeon would decline to do the surgery until she had access to those records. This is really no different than that. I want to emphasize that we have and will continue to keep all patient information confidential as required by state and federal law, and we'll use the expanded access only to triage and care for the individuals that we are ordered to treat by the civil commitment courts. So the language that you have before you will ultimately look a little different as we're working with stakeholders to finalize it, as Representative Edelson mentioned a moment ago. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Stevens. Any other testifiers you have, Representative Edelson?
No, Mr. Chair, and I want to say that the group, the Civil Commitment Working Group, has agreed to allow DHS. They agree that this would be an okay thing to add to House File 2898.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience here today who wishes to be heard on House File 3887? Raise your hand. I don't see any. We'll move to committee discussion. Questions from members. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Edelson, I have a little bit of concerns on this. I understand the concept of this to get the help better, but the patients also have a right to privacy. We have what's called the Minnesota Healthcare Records Act. I'm not sure. I believe this bill might violate that because they're not requiring any release of that medical information before it's passed on. So I just have some concerns on that.
Did you want to comment on that or let it go?
Chair. Actually, I have Ms. Lasek, who is the counsel for the Department of Human Services,
please
may be able to comment on that.
Yourself for the record and go ahead and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. So the Minnesota Health Records Act.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
I apologize. My name is Kelly Lasek. I'm an Associate General Counsel with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, under the Minnesota Health Records Act, there are essentially three ways that data is allowed to be released that's considered protected under that law. One of those is a signed release of information, and the second, and this is under Minnesota Statute 144.293 Subdivision 2, is if there is a specific authorization in law. So it would be our belief that this, because we would be adding statutory language that would specifically allow for this release, that this would not be in violation of the Health Records Act.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3887 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS policy. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is re-referred to HHS policy. The next bill is House File 3780. And where is it? There we go. Okay, the motion on this is that it be re-referred to HHS policy as well. So I will make that motion. I don't see any amendments. So Rep. Edelson, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. House File 3780 is a bill that was provided by the department, and they worked with stakeholders to help put together a safer response path for sex trafficked children and sexually exploited youth as well. So I'm going to go ahead and let my testifier speak about how they found this gap. And honestly, I think it's just something that we really need to fix, and fix right away.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Edelson, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Ladd, and I'm a human trafficking child protection coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Human Services in the Child Safety and Permanency Division. I am honored and proud today to be here to explain to you the proposed language that the Department of Human Services Child Trafficking and Exploitation Workgroup has created over several years. There are three things I'd like to share with you today. The first is that children and youth who are victims of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation in Minnesota today are at an increased risk of harm because of requirements that Child Protection investigate all reports of sex trafficking involving non-caregiver alleged offenders. This actually interferes often with law enforcement's ability to effectively investigate sex trafficking reports of children. Further, there is no mandated training right now for Child Protection staff across Minnesota on this issue. Unfortunately, this often leads to inconsistent and sometimes ineffective services for these child victims and their families. So as a result of those problems, we brought together a group of more than 200 stakeholders across Minnesota, including survivors, child protection agencies, county attorneys, judges, law enforcement, service providers, and tribes to look at this issue and develop a safer and better response for our children and youth. The proposed language in House File 3780 would make children and youth safer here in Minnesota by removing the requirement for Child Protection to interview non-caregiver alleged sex traffickers. And it would return to law enforcement the sole authority to investigate reports of child sex trafficking involving non-caregiver alleged offenders. Instead, Child Protection agencies would conduct a new response focused on safety and access to services for these children. The non-caregiver sex trafficking assessment is what we propose to create. This bill also requires necessary training for all child protection staff across Minnesota so that all of our children and youth will receive the best possible services and the safest response in alignment with Minnesota's safe harbor response. Lastly, I want you all to know that House File 3780 will bring Minnesota into full compliance with the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act and the Federal Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act. But more importantly, these changes will help make Minnesota a safer place for some of our most vulnerable children and youth. Thank you for your attention to this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ladd. Do you have other testifiers, Representative Edelson?
No.
Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3780? Seeing none, then we'll move to committee discussion or questions. Any questions? I don't see any questions. Oh, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I was just listening to the testimony of the testifier. One thing I have concerns with any time we do mandatory training, because a lot of times we get it wrong. But I know with the investigating of any abuse or any issues with a child, social workers generally don't do the interviews. It's a team that does the interviews. And if they're not working as a team involving social services, child protection, law enforcement, a child psychologist, they're not doing their job correctly. And you, unfortunately, it sounded like you said they wasn't doing it as a team with the social worker doing the interview. The social worker should never be doing an interview on a person that's a suspect of a crime with the crime related. That should be done by law enforcement professionals and the investigators. So if the social workers are doing the interviews, I have a serious problem with that. Should they be a part of that interview? Yes, but they probably shouldn't be the one doing the interview. So I'm not sure what this, I still haven't figured out what this bill is trying to do. I'm still trying to understand it more. So that's all I have to say on that.
Understood. Thank you, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Adelson, and your witness. I just have a question on page 7, section I, 720 to 724. It says, the non-caregiver sex trafficking assessment does not include a determination as to whether the child maltreatment occurred, but does determine the need for services to address the safety of the child and family members and the risk of subsequent maltreatment. Can you just explain why it does not require there to be a determination?
Ms. Ladd.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, may I respond to Representative Johnson and Representative Robbins on the questions, please?
Well, you got the votes, so we'll give you as much rope as you want.
Okay, I'll be very brief. So first of all, thank you very much, Representative Johnson, for that very important point. In fact, I believe that members of our work group would all agree with you. It is an unsafe situation to send a child protection social worker out by him or herself to interview an alleged sex trafficker who is not related to the child in any way and very well may be trafficking a number of youth across our state and even across the country. And so, in fact, what this bill tries to do is create, and in response to your question as well, create a different path that focuses on a team environment in which law enforcement takes the lead on investigating and interviewing that non-caregiver sex trafficker. And child protection takes the lead in partnership with our safe harbor providers in really trying to secure safety and services. And it is absolutely essential. You can see actually in Section 16, there are some changes made also to the multidisciplinary team statute to really emphasize how important it is that this is a team effort and that we include all of the relevant providers who are working closely with these youth. And in terms of your question, Representative Robbins, what this is trying to do by removing the maltreatment determination is to shift the focus to safety and services. So requiring still an assessment of the safety needs of the youth and the family, requiring a determination of whether child protection services ongoing are needed, creating a safety plan, and then coordinating with law enforcement to conduct that investigation and interview that alleged offender. So that was the single most dangerous part that is currently of the response was the interview with the alleged offender due to the risk that it poses for the children and the families who are involved. And so by removing that maltreatment determination, we're able to remove that requirement for child protection to interview that alleged offender.
Representative Robbins, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm still not clear why it's necessary to remove the finding of maltreatment. What if there is maltreatment? Can you not say there is?
Ms. Ladd.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, in order to remove the interview requirement, per our federal and state laws, we have to remove the maltreatment determination because of due process reasons, and also because we can't make a finding that someone has committed maltreatment if we've not given them an opportunity to be heard, or an opportunity to make a statement, which is what the interview does.
Thank you. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, as I'm sitting here listening, if the person is a non-caregiver, the maltreatment issue, and it's a crime and it's already doing the sex trafficking, I don't think Social Service should be doing any interviews of the suspect. The same goes, too, with if the perpetrator happens to be the caregiver. Should they be part of the team? Yes. Should they be doing the interviews without law enforcement present? Absolutely not, because that could impede and damage a criminal investigation.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from members of the committee or questions from members of the committee? And there being no one else in the audience who wants to testify, the motion before us is that House File 3780 be recommended to be re-referred to the HHS Policy Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is re-referred to HHS Policy. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Pryor is here on House File 3880. And can I have a motion? That House File 3880 be recommended to re-referred to HHS Policy. And Chair Considine makes that motion. We have an author's amendment labeled A200685. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? Can I have a motion to put the bill in the shape the author so desires?
Move.
Representative Cantrell makes the motion on House File on Amendment A200685. Any discussion? All in favor on the A200685 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Representative Pryor, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I know that you have a full agenda today, so I will be very brief in my comment and just say that this is a bill that makes improvements in both efficiency and also introduces federal compliance on a number of child support statutes. And now I will turn it over to my testifier, Ms. Tara Burton. I said it wrong. Burton. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tara Burton. I'm a staff attorney with the Child Support Division at DHS.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. This bill has three provisions that actually went through this committee and HHS last year in House File 2397. Those three provisions, the first one is on Section 6. This brings the state into federal compliance with the Consumer Credit Protection Act. Currently in Minnesota law, there's a statement in there that says when you take a lump sum for child support purposes, that's not subject to the CCPA. That is false under federal law, so this would remove that. The second provision that did go through last year under House File 2397 deletes a paragraph of our child support credit reporting statute that violates credit reporting standards. Basically, it says that we have to report when someone is paying as ordered by the court. We can't do that just based on the standards of how credit reporting is done. And then the last provision that went through last year helps tribal families by allowing a court case to transfer to the tribal court when the tribe has a 4D child support case open, so that both parts of their child support case are located in one place with their tribal government. So those are the three provisions that were through last year. This year, in addition, we have two new proposals on there. The first one is regarding confidential addresses. The 4D child support program is required to keep addresses confidential when there's a family violence indicator. However, the courts aren't necessarily required to do that, and due to a changing in the way that the courts handle filing, that has recently become an issue. The first version of this had a paragraph in there that would have made the courts required to keep things confidential. We have since made a process with the courts to make that a motion process, so the amendment takes out that provision that would say that the courts have to keep these addresses confidential, and instead that's moving through motion. However, to help smooth that process, this bill, the amendment still does make some changes to that. The first thing is that it allows parents to waive the address protection if they have an OFP. That could happen, for example, if a parent has an order for protection, but they know the other party has the address, or maybe that's not a safety concern, maybe the address is just not an issue. The second thing that it still does is it allows the protection regardless of the source of the concern. So for example, maybe in a child support case, it's not the two parties to the case that have the safety concern, but they don't want this address public because of an outside threat. This would allow that. And then it also adds the joint child as someone who may experience a safety concern. The final thing that this bill does in the last proposal, which is on Section 7, is regarding recreational licenses. Minnesota is required to have a statute on the books that allows suspension of hunting and fishing license. However, there are some issues with reinstating that license. So this would allow the county to bring the reinstatement action. Currently, the statute allows the county to take the license, but does not allow the county to go in and help someone get the license back. That would solve that. It also will allow reinstatement when the 4D case is closing. And it clarifies that this is a motion process, because currently it's not really clear what the court process is to get it back. That is our summary.
Excellent. Thank you. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Pryor?
I do.
Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard, wants to testify on House File 3880 as amended? We'll go to member questions or comments. Any member questions or comments? I don't see any. Representative O'Neill.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. I stepped out for a moment. I was catching up. My question is, do the tribal courts take into consideration the best interest of the child factors and making their determination for custody and parenting time?
Ms. Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tribal courts have their own statutes regarding this, so it's not clear what a tribal court could have. All four tribes that get this would potentially have different statutes. I'm only sort of really familiar with the Mille Lacs Band, and I could tell you that they do take into consideration that sort of thing, but it would depend on tribal statute.
Representative Neal?
Thank you.
Okay. There being no other questions, no other testimony, the motion before us is from Representative Considine that the bill, House File 3880, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to HHS policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 3880, as amended, is referred to HHS policy. Is this the last bill?
Yeah.
Okay. Well done, members. We have before us Representative Neuer. Representative Neuer moves that House File 3812 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS policy. This feels like public safety last week, where every single bill was referred to judiciary. And then I was feeling a little inundated. Good thing Representative Moran isn't here right now. But you don't have any amendments, as I see. So Representative Neuer moves that House File 3812 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS policy. Representative Neuer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, since this is the last bill, I'll make it short and quick. This is a child safety and permanency policy bill. It has got several components, and it also addresses compliance with the Federal Family First Prevention Service Act before it becomes effective on October 21, 2021. We do have an amendment that we cannot get it through, so we have spoken to many of the stakeholders. And we've listened, and we will be introducing an amendment in the next phase of the bill.
Understood. And if, keeping that in mind, Representative Neuer, if we could, I don't know if NAMI is going to testify on the bill or not, but with the understanding that there is a kind of compromise in the offing or not, I don't know, whatever. But let's just keep that in mind. I don't want to hash out too much if, in fact, there's an amendment that's going to come forward. Go ahead, Representative Neuer.
Mr. Chair, members, I do have Deputy Assistant Commissioner Bailey with the Department of Human Services to give us a little bit briefing about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lisa Bailey. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at DHS. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today about the Child Safety and Permanency Policy Bill. There are three major provisions or separate provisions of this bill, and I'll just go through them one by one. The first one addresses when a child maltreatment report is made about an Indian child living on tribal land that also may overlap with a county. Without this legislative change, at the moment, it's a little it's unclear whether or not a county has authority to refer that report to the tribal social services department for further investigation. So this legislative change would allow the counties, and these are for non-initiative tribes, would allow the county and the tribe to enter into an agreement to make it clear that they do have that authority. And we think that this respects the sovereignty of the tribes and recognizes that there are tribal governments with increased capacity to provide child protective services to their children and families living on the reservation. The second portion of the bill is about minor consent. And at the moment, unaccompanied minors who are experiencing homelessness need access to homeless youth services or services for sexually exploited youth, and they're unable to give consent for those services. So there's sort of a catch-22 where they can't give consent, but they may have some reason why they're not able to get that consent from the parents. This would allow the youth to actually be the ones to give consent for those services. What this would keep the current requirements about mandated reporting on the part of the provider, as well as the current notification to parents requirements that are also there. So that would stay in place, but it would allow that sort of conundrum to be removed and allow the youth to give consent.
Thank you.
The third is the more major portion. As Representative Norm mentioned, this is about the Family First Prevention Services Act. As I'm sure this body is well aware, at the moment, the way that foster care and out-of-home placement for children is paid for is half of that, 50% of those services are paid for under Title IV-E of the Social Services Act. In 2018, and just to give you some perspective, total amounts is about $200 million a year. That's total. About half of that is paid for through Title IV-E. And for these out-of-home placement services, that in last year was about $15 million. That's the total amount. And of that, the state paid for half of that, approximately half of that. In 2018, a fairly major change was made to the Title IV-E, and that's the Family First Prevention Services Act, which I'm sure this body knows is a very complex act with lots of different moving parts to it. They gave us the state until the fall of 2021 to do all the things we need to do to get ready for the implementation of that act. So it will actually go into effect in October of 2021. One of the major changes that they made is that starting on in October of 2021, at the moment, as I said, the Title IV-E will pay for 50% of those out-of-home placement costs. Starting in October of 2021, only 14 days will be paid for by the federal government, unless certain exceptions are met. And I will tell you what those exceptions are. It also adds fairly stringent requirements for, or fairly significant additions and requirements for assessments to be made and for screening to be made and for an additional new court process. The exceptions that are made that will allow for longer term payments are if it's a setting that specializes in prenatal, postpartum, or parenting supports for youth, if it's a setting that provides high quality residential care for youth who are found to be victims of sex trafficking, or a licensed residential family-based treatment facility for substance abuse when the child is co-located with the parent. And finally, significantly, it allows for the state to establish something called a QRTP, which is a qualified residential treatment facility. And to become a QRTP, the facilities, and it could be a current facility or it could be a new one, has to meet some fairly stringent federal requirements. And I won't go through all of those, but they're fairly significant. It would be a big deal for a current facility to become one of these QRTPs.
Ms. Bailey, thank you for not going through those, and I want to remind you that the purview of this committee will be the court process. So thanks for laying all that out, but I'm not really going to entertain questions on the other areas that...
Thank you. I'll go through. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go through those court processes. One of them is that the assessment that will be required regarding the appropriateness of that level of care, and that would need to be done by what's called a qualified individual. A qualified individual is defined in this law as a trained professional or licensed clinician who is not an employee of the agency, who will maintain objectivity for then reviewing whether or not this is the most appropriate placement. So that's a new requirement. And the family must be engaged in the assessment of that child's strengths and needs and to determine whether or not the child's needs could be met in a less restrictive setting. That assessment needs to be completed before or within 30 days of that placement. The second requirement, the new change, is that within 60 days of the QRTP placement, the court must consider that 30-day assessment of the appropriateness, then determine whether make a finding whether or not the needs of the child can be met through placement in a foster family home or if there is another least restrictive setting, and then approve or disprove the placement. And the Children's Justice Initiative is reviewing the Title IV-E requirements and developing court rules and information for the court review. And as long as that foster child then is placed in a QRTP, the county must submit evidence at each review and permanency hearing about that child's placement. And I can go in further into that if this body wishes. So we understand that there are some, this is not, well, I'll back up. We have been doing a great deal over the last year of community outreach, meeting with providers and with advocates, people with lived experience on this, to discuss these changes. And you may ask why we're doing this now when we have another legislative session. That's essentially because we need time to get all of this in place, to figure out, get this sort of structure of the statute in place, to then be able to have time to get the court rules, the processes, the training, for judges, lawyers, social workers, and get all of the claiming systems work in place as well. So that's why we feel strongly this needs to happen this year. We're concerned about the ability of counties to be able to draw down these 4E monies if we're not getting this in place soon.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Are there any other testifiers that you have, Representative Noor?
No.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this? Ms. Aberholden? Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And on behalf of my organization and the countless families who have a child with a serious mental illness, I want to strongly express our opposition to this bill. I know you don't have much time, but this is a really important bill that will negatively impact families who have a child with a serious mental illness. You have to put this into context. Back in 1999, Bazelon did a big study where they showed that basically parents of children with serious mental illnesses had to relinquish custody of their children in order for the child to receive treatment, especially residential treatment. This was happening in over half the states, including in Minnesota, although our law at the time gave the court power to order treatment for children both in and out of home while prohibiting the child welfare agency from taking custody. And while technically they didn't take custody, we know that it happened, and parents still had to go through the child protection system to obtain residential care for their child. This, of course, I want to point out, it's residential care needed due to the child's serious mental illness, not because the parent had neglected or abused their child. I want committee members to understand how humiliating and stigmatizing it was for families to go through the child protection system, including to go to court, just to obtain needed treatment for their child. And I want to point out how difficult it is to obtain more intensive services in the home to prevent residential treatment. Private insurance doesn't cover in-home mental health services. The eligibility criteria to obtain TEFRA is higher for children with mental illnesses. And frankly, the intensive services simply don't exist, so families don't have any options. In 2007, after much hard work with department, state court administration, children's providers, and advocates, we created 260D, which is a voluntary placement agreement, so that families didn't necessarily have to go through child protection, and they didn't have to show up in court to say that their child needed treatment. There are 25 other states that have voluntary placements. This bill upends this work. The family and permanency team, or the screening team, consists of teachers, medical or mental health providers, and others. The county can veto a possible member of the team, but parents cannot. We don't know how HIPAA plays out in this scenario, especially if parents don't grant permission for the child's medical records to be viewed by the people the county invites to the meeting. There is language stating that the agency must engage the child and parents to determine appropriate team members, but engage is not the same as agree to. The definition of qualified individual is very vague, and this is the person who really is making a decision about whether residential care is needed and the child's treatment goals, both long and short term, even though they aren't treating the child. Who chooses this person? What are their qualifications? The assessment will be completed on a form prescribed by the commissioner, but there's nothing about the process. The federal law does allow states to apply for a waiver, so the independent assessment could be done by a state employee or an employee of a qualified residential treatment provider. Relative searches are required under this bill, even when the child needs intensive treatment. The language in the bill states that it shall request input from the parents, but again, that is not the same as the parent agreeing to whom can be contacted. And what happens if a relative says yes, that they are willing to take to the child, but it's clear that this person has no skills or training to care for a child with a serious mental illness? We believe the federal law does not require relative search when the qualified individual has determined that the needs cannot be met by family members or a family foster home. With this bill, we are putting families back in the position of defending themselves as parents and explaining the intensive needs of their child. DHS is going to require a relative search. Can you imagine, without your permission, the county sending a letter to all your relatives asking if any of them are willing to care for your child? Can you imagine, without your permission, the county inviting teachers, relatives, pastors, and others to a meeting to discuss your child and your family, sharing sensitive information and medical information? There's a great deal of misunderstanding around mental illnesses in children, and families will tell you they get a lot of bad advice. If you just were more strict, if you just did this, and now DHS wants to send a letter to them. Nothing in the Family First Act impacted voluntary placement agreements. The federal law allows them to continue, and absolutely no changes were made to this section. Additionally, since 2008, the federal law has required diligent efforts to identify relatives of a child entering foster care and to notify those relatives of the option of taking part in the child's care and placement. The Family First Law made no changes to the section, so why are we changing it now? Please don't make parents go through this. They've already gone through a lot by the time they seek residential treatment. These children are not being removed from the home. They are being placed into treatment. There is one thing that the state could do, and I'm pleased to see Representative Liebling here, is that we no longer have Medicaid funds to pay for the treatment in residential care. We could use state funds to pay for the room and board, and families then would not have to go through this. I urge you to really consider the seriousness of this bill and the negative impact this is going to have on the families that we represent. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Abderholden. Are there other folks? Let's see. Who else wants to be heard on this bill? Raise your hand. Got one? And one more testifier. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I serve as executive director of Aspire Minnesota. We're an association of children service providers who serve in the areas of children's mental health, child welfare, juvenile justice, and an array of community services in support of children, youth, and families across the state. Since February of 2018, passage of the Federal Family First Preservation Services Act, leaders throughout our children's services field have been in discussion about how Family First can truly transform our system for kids and families in the state of Minnesota, truly make our system driven by family need, truly create a system that we don't have today. And that is because the act itself opens up the use of Title IV E funds to do much more early intervention and prevention work that we haven't yet established in the state of Minnesota. You can see those ambitious reflected in the handouts we provided to you today. So we have a lot of faith and belief that we can really leverage this opportunity to make great things happen in the state of Minnesota. And as you see in House File 3812, it brings forward the more restrictive components of how Family First prevents use of Title IV child welfare funding in congregate care settings and outlines how QRTPs will be established as a new standard. Aspire Minnesota is actively engaging with DHS on improving the language as DHS also seeks to conform to these new federal standards, all of which are very important, as we all know. Today, we submit to you a few high-level examples of concerns we have with the bill as it relates to the oversight required by the courts. The language establishes a new system of assessment, placement, and service delivery review for children in voluntary and involuntary placement and treatment services. Each of these steps has yet to be fully defined and vetted and establishes new authority and yet to be defined roles. We have significant concern about the system as proposed in the language before you and the capacity of the courts to review challenges as seen in, again, at a high level, voluntary placement, as Sue Abderholden outlined very, very well already. Through this new standard of care and QRTPs, that is fundamentally about delivering treatment services and quality treatment language reflecting what treatment is, best practice, goals, and design aren't reflected or honored in any of the language. The new QRTP level of care is intended to meet critical treatment needs of Minnesota's children, yet there's no process for crisis placements, and we know systemic improvements to our mental health system require crisis and emergency responses as this continues to be a great need. Though access to service is determined by the new rules and new authority, including the authority to deny service and require children to be served at home instead of accessing treatment, there are no appeals processes included. Children, family members, and other process stakeholders require the ability for appeals to officially safeguard autonomy and submit personal and professional level opinions on decisions to best serve children and families. Finally, as this new level of care frequently references the best interests of the child and services in the least restrictive setting, when a child is denied access to a QRTP based on assessment indicating care can be provided in a home, there are no standards and no outline of services that can meet a child's treatment needs at this less restrictive setting, meaning this design creates a cliff with the new QRTP standard that is 4E reimbursed and prevents 4E from use in less restrictive settings. Minnesota children and youth deserve much more than what we have here. We must embrace the need and opportunity to define what is needed to serve our children and youth with treatment needs.
at all levels of needs, in their home, in community-based group care and residential treatment, and all of the creative ways to serve our community that we can serve in our communities. We look forward to continuing to work with toward solutions to these issues with DHS and all stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Anderson. There being no one else in the audience who's testifying on this, we have Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would really, I have to say that, you know, these kinds of disagreements are really hard to lay out in committee, and this committee, honestly, is not the right committee for this. And so I just really want to suggest to the people here who have problems with the bill that you all, and to DHS, I strongly suggest that you sit down together and figure out a solution here, because I think this is a bill that needs to move. But members are going to be really reluctant. We don't usually ignore Ms. Abderholden's testimony. And, you know, I just, we're not going to work it out in a setting like this. So this is really disappointing to me that we're here today in this setting with these kinds of issues. I just really hope you all can sit down and at least present, you know, some amendments or some possible solutions. I mean, Ms. Abderholden said something, but this is not the committee for that. Just wanted to get that out, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And Chair Liebling's committee is going to be one, well, this is going to policy. Okay, but Chair Liebling, you know, sits on that committee too. And I'll tell you that too. The bill's here for not necessarily what we're talking about. It's here for the judiciary provisions. However, it does give me a little bit of heartburn to vote for it, considering the reservations that have been put forward. And yet, at the same time, I'm probably going to vote to move it out of this committee today, but it's one of those bills that I'll probably keep an eye on to see whether or not y'all are working together to address the concerns that have been laid forth. So I just wanted to state that. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Knorr. I also have the same concerns that Chair Lesh just brought up. Unfortunately, today we're hearing a lot of bills that are going to HHS that should have probably gone to HHS policy first and then to this committee. Because they're going to make a lot of changes over in that committee, and it could make major changes in the judiciary part of it. I'm going to make a suggestion to Chair Lesh to send this to HHS without recommendation and bring it back. I've heard rumors of a complete DE amendment for this bill specifically. I think we should let them take care of it, then bring it back here so we can take care of the judicial issues in case there's some major changes that affect it dramatically.
Well, Chair Johnson, what I'd do is, and I appreciate and respect your recommendation on that. What I would say is we keep an eye on all of these. And if the bill goes to another committee and they make major changes to an area that is within another committee's jurisdiction, it's incumbent on committee staff to work together on that, for HHS, CA to inform RCA, and then if it gets to the floor and it skipped past us, you know, I'm answerable to that. You're going to hold me accountable to that. Chair Scott's going to hold me accountable to that. So we need to do that. I'm not going to put it out there to ask for it back, but I will say, hey, if you mess around with judiciary stuff and you don't tell us, it's going to be a problem. Is that adequate, Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, I'm not sure if I can just go that because of the condition of this bill and the some of the testimony we're hearing. I have even trouble if it's not coming back here after, especially when we're hearing rumors of a complete DE amendment. I'd have trouble even sending it out.
Understood, Chair Johnson. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad that I'm not the only one that has concerns around this table, based on the testimony that was given and some of the most troubling aspects of what Ms. Abderholden testified to me were the fact that parents have to go to court in a humiliating process just to still be the parents of their child and not have them legally removed from the home. And so that would be an area that I would highly encourage all the stakeholders to work on. And I do have one question that concerns the top of page 5, and it's minor consent to homeless and sexually exploited youth services. And I'm wondering, and I'm assuming this is a question for the testifier that's at the table from the department, is there an age restriction or an age of accountability by which you allow a child to give consent?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Ms. Bailey, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, if I may call up one of my colleagues who is the subject matter expert on this, he can address that.
Please introduce yourself for the record and address the question.
Thank you. My name is Ryan Johnson, and I work for the Department of Human Services. Chairperson and representative, there isn't currently in the bill an age restriction on this, but if children came to a homeless youth provider or a provider that was providing services for sexually exploited youth, those folks would be covered under mandated reporting laws, so they would have to report that child to Child Protective Services.
Sure, Scott.
Okay, I just, when I see a child giving a consent, I like, is this the first six-year-old? I mean, is there any value, I guess, Mr. Chair, thank you, and to the testifier, is there any value in placing an age on it, or because children of all ages are subject to this kind of exploitation, that's why there's no age determination in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, if I may.
Go ahead, Ms. Bailey.
The language of this bill was developed through the Council on Homelessness, and there's been much discussion around this very issue. As I understand it, the agreement to not put something in there was to address, there are certain situations where, say, at the moment, because there, let's just say it was a 10-year-old who arrived, I mean, it'd be an unusual situation, but who arrived at 10 o'clock at night, everything is closed, and there is no way for that provider to even accept this child into their care until the next morning. And so they would have to call the police, and then that would start an entire police process, which might not necessarily be required. And so that's the way it currently works, as I understand it. This would allow that child to then be there until the next morning. They can get they're still going to have the parental notification requirements, which is required under the licensing statute, and they're still going to have the mandated reporter requirements. But we had this sort of unusual situation now where, and that would require them to make an immediate notification. But we have this unusual situation now where a provider could be in violation of their license if they even admitted that child in the front door. So that, as I understand it, that's why there wasn't a hard and fast age limit put on that, because they had these weird situations where they didn't want to violate their license requirements, but they also wanted to bring this child in from out of the cold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just one other point that I wanted to point out for the stakeholders based on Ms. Abderholden's testimony was the whole issue of health records and that child's health records and who controls them. And so I would want to make sure that in this bill that it's obviously subject to the Minnesota Health Records Act, and first and foremost, which is our current law, and then to HIPAA, and that the parents should remain in control of those records to the extent possible. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't express strongly enough how problematic this bill is. We need to be very careful when we're moving forward with this, and if NAMI comes forward with, and Mrs. Abderholden has strong opposition. Now, I've been around for a while, and I don't hear her use those words very often. You all know that. Representative Scott, Representative Lesh, Chair Lesh, you know that she doesn't come up and say, I have strong opposition to this, and then go down a very, very long list of problematic things within this bill. And just in the jurisdiction of this committee alone, not even talking about the HHS problems in this bill, this should not move forward. This has got serious problems. It doesn't have an appeal process. You're violating families' privacy rights by sending out letters to whomever you feel like without any permission given whatsoever. Who knows what you're going to put in those letters? The parents are expected to give up custody to get treatment. I mean, I've been here almost, this is my eighth year. I have not heard these kind of words coming from NAMI before. This is incredibly serious. This should not move forward. And I realize process. This is problematic to the point where I want this laid on the table. This can, just in this jurisdiction alone, there are serious problems with this bill moving forward. We haven't even gotten to the HHS problems with it. We haven't even talked about that. But this should not move forward until some of these major issues are dealt with. The problems brought up were beyond anything I've heard in years here in this legislature. This should not move forward, Mr. Chair.
Representative Noor, what's the path for this bill? What's the committee path for the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, I think there's some few confusions. Nobody's going to send letters to everybody. I think
What's the committee
path? So it's going to go to HHS policy, and we do have some compromise bill that we're working on to finalize. It should have come to this committee. Unfortunately, because of the timing, we were unable to finalize, and I will make sure that the department works with NAMI and other stakeholders to get it done.
Okay, so the only other committee this is going to is HHS policy?
That's correct.
It's a policy bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Has it already been scheduled for next week?
We're hoping it's scheduled for Friday.
Is this bill meeting deadline in the Senate?
Mr. Chair, as you know, it's unclear right now, but it's still pending us to move forward in the House.
Well, Representative Noor, I'm strongly inclined to defer to some of the recommendations of the people on this committee to lay it over until some of the stuff's been figured out. This is, honestly, this is not on you, okay? This is an agency problem. The same thing happened last year with Commerce when Commerce had a bill that had been pending through the previous administration for changes that were required on federal conformity. And they knew it across the administration to the current administration. And you can cut the current administration some slack on that because they picked this up. But in general, the agency had known about it for over a year. And all of a sudden, deadline week comes, and we got to fix it for the agency. I do not appreciate being put in that position as a chair because I got to carry this bill because it's an agency bill and you want to get it done. And here we are Wednesday, the week before deadline. And this is the first I hear about this controversy. And we did it last year. We delivered for Commerce, and Commerce isn't the only one. This happened with other agencies. I really, I don't like it at all.
Mr. Chair.
I don't know if you really want to respond, Ms. Bailey, but if you want to, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate first that we do have a delete all amendment that was apparently it's with the reviser, and it's due to be finished on Thursday, we understand. We hope that that will address many but probably not all of the concerns. We are also very, very understanding of what the issue is. The federal law does not make a difference between voluntary and involuntary placements. However, and at the moment, that is how we fund these out-of-home placements. We are also very willing to work with NAMI, with Ms. Ebderholden, on figuring out a way that we could, whether it would be to carve something out for this year, to figure out some other path forward so that we can get the rest of the bill forward so that we can get all of these training and the systems work done while we work through how to address these voluntary placement options. So we're absolutely open to that. We understand what the issue is. It's a substantive issue. It's not really just a sort of tweaking it here at the edges. We do have some methods in place, or as I understand it, to deal with the appeals issue and some of the crisis placement issues and some of the things that Ms. Anderson raised. And we've been working closely with her and have been in close communication with Ms. Ebderholden. So we've known about these concerns. Some of it is just it's very substantive. We have a difference in how these are funded and sort of where we have what our requirements are. So we're absolutely willing to work on that, and just want to reiterate that this is not something of us saying it must go through in this exact format, but we are, you know, following those federal requirements in terms of what we have to get in place.
Representative O'Neill.
So I would just reiterate, Mr. Chair, if there is a DE, can we just lay this over until the DE is completed? We can at least talk about further along what this bill is further along. I just feel like I've never heard Ms. Abderholden used those strong of words and how much opposition she has. If we could just lay this over until the DE is done, we could pick it back up and have a full conversation about the changes.
Okay. Representative Noor, first of all, I would ask, can you give me a north-south, Ms. Abderholden? Have you seen the DE? Okay. Chair lays the bill over. What's going to happen, Representative Noor, on this is get the parties together immediately. Okay. We'll take it up as soon as we can and notice it as soon as we can once there's some action has been taken on it. You're going to be in, need to be in touch with the CA for HHS to make sure that they're aware that if, in fact, you get a deal done, it gets sent there immediately or as soon as possible to meet your deadline, okay? All right. Thank you. Members, there is no other business before the committee, but we do have tomorrow House File 3975, Representative Mariani, 3181, Representative Claflin, 3878, Representative Carlson, and House File 4044, the revisers bill. So, yeah. That being said, committee's adjourned.